Welcome to this special Lauriston Girls School podcast about the OLA Fellowship, a $5,000 contribution to support professional development to help deliver a unique project, research, or further study in the recipient's related field. I'm Sabina Reid. I'm a psychologist, speaker, and media commentator, and I'm a proud old girl from the class of 1988. In this inspiring conversation, I'm joined by the inaugural OLA Fellowship 2021 recipient, Dr. Sophie Tissot, and Steph Parsons, who was awarded the OLA Fellowship in 2022. Spanning careers in medicine and surgery, film and TV, and the law, these two wise and curious humans invite us into their lives to share some of their career insights and uncertainties. Along the way, we learn about the power of having someone else believe in you, what it means to be a Lauriston girl, and perhaps that there's a lifelong learner living within most of us. If you're an old girl thinking of applying for this year's 2023 fellowship, even if there's a little voice inside your head questioning whether you're worthy enough, or if you're a passionate and generous person who would like to fund future fellowships to help more old girls on their career journeys, or perhaps you're looking for some career inspiration of your own, or simply if you're curious about interesting career stories, then I know there are some gems for you in this conversation. For more information or to apply, please go to ola.org.au/OLA Fellowship. And remember, applications close on the 1st of August, so you better hop to it. Here's our conversation with Sophie and Steph. Sophie, I want to start with you. You were the inaugural winner of the, or recipient of the OLA Fellowship. Now, you graduated from med school in Adelaide and then you went on to become a urology surgical trainee and a robotics fellow at St. Vincent's Hospital. Help us understand what being a surgeon represents to you.
Oh, being a surgeon, well, it's a whole lifestyle, that's for sure. And it's a commitment. I think I started medical school 15 years ago and I'm 2 months away from my final exam, so it's a pretty big commitment. Being a surgeon is 24/7. I wake up at 5 in the morning and do a bit of study and hit my ward rounds at 7 in the morning, and I've spoken with 20 patients in an hour. And then we operate during the day and manage our teams, and at the end of the day, you're thinking about what you've done and what the next day comes. So I'm completely obsessed with my job. And I think if I wasn't, you couldn't do it. So I just love the career that I've chosen. And even though it's hard work, it's something that makes me really happy. And I just can't wait to see what the rest of my career holds because of that.
And some of us know when we're very young what we want to do, and others we chop and change along the way. Was it something that you always were drawn to?
I was drawn to it because I grew up doing surf lifesaving and doing first aid on the beach, and I loved that side of it. And I loved interacting with people when they were at their most vulnerable. And I think because of that and doing all the STEM subjects at Lauriston, it made me want to pursue medicine.
Mm. I also read, Sophie, that your aunt, who you were very close to, died in with regards to complications related to surgery. Is that correct? Have I got that right?
Yeah, it is correct.
How does a life event like that, when someone you're so close to, in a context, in a setting that you know so well, how does that impact you?
Significantly. So I was actually quite involved at the time when she was unwell, being so close to her and being the only medico in my family. It happened about 6 months before I started surgical training. So I just got onto the program and then this happened, and she was one of those very rare complications that happened. And I think it impacted my learning curve as I was learning to be a surgeon, knowing what a significant impact we can make on people's lives. But I think overall and through going through my journey of learning how to operate, I think it's made me overall just so much more of an empathetic surgeon, and made me realize how important communication is too, because things do go wrong, and that's why we consent people for them, and surgery is not easy and people are sick and things happen, but it's all about how you communicate and discuss with the patient and their family. And it's certainly something that I think has made me a more holistic and well-rounded surgeon.
Yeah, that's a beautiful insight after what sounds like a very painful and difficult experience for you personally and also professionally.
Yeah.
I'm going to turn to you now, Steph. You were the second recipient of the OLA Fellowship, and yours is an interesting pathway. You started after leaving Lauriston, completing a Bachelor of Film and TV at the VCA, and then focused on what you refer to as the camera team. Would you call that cinematography? What would the language be there?
Yeah, I wanted to be a cinematographer, but I dabbled, as a lot of people do in the film industry, in a lot of different roles. So I had production roles, as in on the producing side rather than on the production design side. A few directing roles, but mostly I was working towards cinematography, which means that I worked as a first assistant, first camera assistant, also sometimes known as a focus puller, and a second camera assistant. So at different points within the team that works with the cinematographer.
And what was it about cinematography that you were so passionate about? How did you imagine this career to look as a cinematographer?
That's a great question. And if I'm honest, I think it's something of a naivete about it, that coming out of film school, the desire to work in a team, it was a role that I really enjoyed when I was at film school, because it has a set of rules that you need to know how to use in order to tell a story. And I've always straddled the boundary between academic and creative. So I don't work well in a purely creative environment where I can do anything, but I do work well in a creative environment where I have a set of rules. So cinematography suited me. I liked working in the team, and honestly, there's more opportunities. I mean, a lot of people come out of film school and they want to be a director, and there's not many people can be directors. I was drawn to it. I was drawn to the team environment and to working with tools, working on my feet, working physically as well as creatively. There's a lot of different fields of knowledge that you need to work in that kind of environment, which I enjoyed.
And then only 3 or 4 years later, I think it's correct to say, you went back to study law.
Yeah. So it's a natural pipeline from film to law. So I went overseas and I came back and I did a refresher course for camera assisting. And I remember an interview with a guy who said he'd been camera assisting for about 20 years. And I was like, realized in that moment that even as much as I enjoyed it, I looked 20 years into my future and I thought, I don't think that I want to do this for the rest of my life. Not because I didn't enjoy it, just because it didn't feel like there was enough room for growth for the kind of work that I wanted to do. I ummed and ahed, and I had a crisis of faith about, you know, who I was and if it was a bad idea to leave a career pathway or if I could blend it with a different career pathway. And it's interesting hearing Sophie talk about a sort of single-mindedness of loving your job, because I am the complete opposite. I have no single focus, and I never have. I've always wanted to know a little bit about everything and live in 100 different worlds and have a lot of different outputs and a lot of different skills. I kind of returned to what I was good at, which was, again, total opposite of Sophie. No science, no maths, 100% language, philosophy, comprehension, that kind of stuff. And the natural fit was law school. My mum is a lawyer as well. So there was a bit more of a, I didn't go in totally blind.
What do you think some of the transferable skills are that overlap between the arts and commercial law?
Yeah, it's a very good question, and I should preface it my answer by saying that film is a very unusual art form, because a lot of art forms can be done solo. You can write a book solo, you can dance if you want solo, you can act with only a couple of other people, but to make a film you really need a massive team, and if you don't have a massive team, you need a small team with a massive set of skills. So a lot of the skills that you learn in filmmaking are about project management, people management, negotiating, about getting what you want while helping other people get what they want at the same time, working together as a team. And particularly the one that I find the most transferable to law is knowing when to buy into other people's stress. If someone else is worried about something, someone else is freaking out about something, whether you should absorb that and also freak out, or if it's your job to keep your cool head. And I find that I learned a lot of that at film school or in the film industry, and I've used it a lot as a lawyer.
Yeah, so there's a lot of overlap that people may not see on face value. Yeah. I think I also read that you learnt at Howqua, the Year 9 program at Lauriston that's so fabulous, that you learnt how to tolerate or cope with other people's tears at Howqua. That might also come in handy both in film and in law. Is that something you said?
I naturally buy into other people's emotions a lot, and I think that it's a really useful skill to know when it's your fault and when you can help them and when you need to just step away and how much of it you need to take on. You know, you can help people without taking on their strain as your own strain, which I'm sure Sophie would deal with a lot at work as well.
That'd be correct for you, Sophie, wouldn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I can relate to that as a psychologist as well. So there are probably skills that we all can tap into, but I was too old to go to Howqua. I had to learn it along a long life's journey instead of at Howqua. We're kind of moving into, well, there's some overlap here around the topic of technology. And Sophie, for you, you know, many years ago, I don't know that we would have thought of technology and medicine as so intertwined as they are becoming. Perhaps we could say that for every single industry. You have become really involved in robotics, as we said earlier. What actually is robotic surgery? Because the idea of a robot doing surgery on me kind of leaves me cold.
Yeah. Well, it doesn't kind of roll in and go beep, beep, pop, pop, and then your appendix is out. It's a little bit more intricate than that. The robots that I work on they're actually master-slave systems, which means it's not the robot just doing its own thing. It's under the control of a human that's making it move. But essentially, they are just incredible technology that allows us to get into difficult places and with lots of detail. So with our big hands, you know, it turns the movements down, it gets rid of the tremor. It means you can turn your hand fully around and back around again with the same arm. So and it does it all in 3D with 10 times magnification. So it's like playing the most incredible computer game that you can think of. It's pretty incredible. And you can have a cup of coffee at the same time as well, because you're not scrubbed in at the bedside, so you're not sterile. So you just sit there in your colourful socks and your cup of coffee and you go ahead.
It is kind of mind-blowing to hear you speak about it. Like, mine still goes back to the old game of Operation, which we had as kids. But even that game would no longer look like it did when I was a child. I'm sure now it has a lot of electronics associated with it instead of just fishing little body parts out of a model.
Yeah.
Okay. How does it impact or what are the benefits for – you've given some insights from the doctor's perspective, but what are some of the benefits for the patient?
Many of the benefits for the patient we might not ever know, because now people are very unlikely to go into a study where they just randomly get told they have to have a robot operation or an old school open operation. The things we do know is they have, it's all keyhole, so tiny little incisions, they get out of the hospital quicker, they're much less likely to have bleeding where they need blood transfusions or whatnot. But certainly in my experience, I mean, the main operation that we use robots for is to remove men's prostates in prostate cancer. And so with this, there's very delicate and important nerves that are down in that area. And, you know, we can see them and move them aside and protect them and look after them. So it's that kind of detail that I think is certainly a benefit for the patient.
I mean, my head is just spinning thinking about both of your careers and how it's just fascinating, and how many people, and I can see Steph shaking her head too, like this is foreign.
It's just astounding. Yeah, it's astounding. It's phenomenal.
It is phenomenal and it is astounding. And so many people have extraordinary jobs we don't know enough about. It's inspirational to hear the career pathways that you're both on. What led you both to apply for the OLA fellowship?
Well, I saw it in the newsletter and it was just at a time at my life where I think I have so much appreciation for Lauriston and what it gave to me. And I'd been disconnected, you know, for 10, 12 years. And I just saw it and thought it would just be great to do something to connect me back to Lauriston before having to wait to have my own kids and, you know, send my daughter, if I'm lucky enough to have one, back to Lauriston. You know, I just thought it was a great reason to reconnect without needing much of an excuse. And it just happened to happen at a time when I had the hydrogel model operating for robotics happening in parallel. And I thought, what a great thing to connect the two. And one of the biggest reasons why I probably got involved is because of my inquisitive nature that I got given by being a Lauriston girl. So I just felt it just happened to be this perfect match and what great timing. And it was just a sign that I felt like it was something I should apply for.
What was the process like for you in applying for it? Because we'll have people listening thinking, is this for me? Do I have to be in robotics? Do I have to work in law? Do I have to have been in film and TV? Do I need to be making a career change? What was the process like?
The process was so easy and it was so much fun, actually, to be honest. I didn't really know what to do. You have to answer a series of questions just about who you are and what the project is or why you're applying for the fellowship. I've had a few people ask me about that since that were thinking of applying themselves with such diverse things and such diverse projects. And then you do this interview mine was on Zoom at the time, must have been COVID era. And it was pretty cool to reconnect with some of the OLA girls and of all different generations and just chat. And you realize that we're really all the same at heart, I think. Lauriston girls are just the same. So I just loved that process. And even if I hadn't have been the winner, being part of the process was just a really lovely thing. And it was really nostalgic. I really enjoyed it.
And for you, Steph, what led you to applying?
Yeah, so I had the good fortune of retaining a lot of friends from high school, but I have now ended up in a workplace where I work with 4 or 5 Lauriston alumni. I don't know what it is about the firm, the law firm where I work, but it draws in old Lauristonians for some reason. A woman that I'm working with, Steph, who I also taught to row when I was at Lauriston, she is involved as the junior old Lauriston, in part of the junior old Lauristonians cohort. And so she knew about the fellowship and she encouraged me to apply. And I must say that when I applied, I didn't really think that I was a good candidate. I especially looked at Sophie's application from the previous year. I thought there's no way that I have any ideas that are as contribute to society in the same way or are as compelling or as clear-minded in their focus of what the project would be that the fellowship would be used for. But I, at the time, had just been appointed to the board of directors of Channel 31, which is Melbourne's most significant and maybe our only remaining community television channel and has been around for a very long time, has been the launching pad of a lot of Australian television careers. I'd just been appointed to the board of this television channel, which is a not-for-profit. And even though I've been to law school and I work in commercial law, I realised that I had no practical understanding of the role of a director. And I found that a little bit stressful as a person who has had the privilege of a very good education to go into something without having education behind me. And I thought, well, I could use the money to get some directorship training and get some not-for-profit directorship training. And then exactly like Sophie, I was like, look, it's a punt. We'll see how we go. And then the interview process was the most affirming interview process I've ever had. And normally I walk out of an interview thinking, I have no idea what they thought of me. God, I probably ruined that whole thing. And I walked out feeling like I knew what I was talking about. Everyone was really supportive. I understood what I'd been telling them. Like, it was great. It was really very straightforward process. And then receiving the fellowship has been extremely affirming, because I think coming into an environment where everyone has been focusing on the law for their whole career, and you're an outlier in that you've got this other set of skills as well and this other focus, there can sometimes be moments of shakiness in self-confidence about whether or not you should have done a commerce degree instead of a fine arts degree. And I'm certain that it would have helped, but the experience of being given the fellowship was really affirming and really made me feel like, oh, I actually do know what I'm doing, and there are other people that believe in me as well. And particularly for me, where the pathway through blending all of these skills together is not clear. Like, I don't have my partner, Sophie, is a doctor, and his pathway through his career is very stepped.
Very structured, yeah.
Extremely structured. And it's very difficult to get through the steps, but they're always laid out in front of him.
Yeah.
The process of becoming a lawyer, film producer, not-for-profit director.
There isn't a manual for that. I thought there was some kind of tick box.
Yeah, there's really not. And it really requires me to take a punt on myself. And this fellowship was the first time that I felt like that punt was paying off in a way that other people were recognizing what I was setting out to do. And I'm still at the very, very beginning of that process and of that career path, but I've never felt more like what I wanted to do was resonating with other people as I have in the process of receiving this fellowship.
Beautiful. It sounds like a really affirming process for both of you. And if I can just reflect, just recently I organised and attended my 35th school reunion as an old girl at Lauriston. And I said a few very brief words, and the essence of them was that we're really here for connection, not comparison.
Yeah.
In our younger years, and even when we let our, you know, noisy inner narrative take over, comparison's something a lot of us experience. And I'm going to sound like a psychologist now, but I think I'm allowed to. And I can hear Steph, you saying that you thought, am I worthy of this? Am I as good as the recipient that went before me? Is this a safe place for me to play, or am I going to get egg on my face? All of these questions are really normal questions. And I think, you know, not just when we're applying for a fellowship, but if we're turning up at a reunion, or if we're going for a job interview, or in any place, it's easy to think, how do I fit with these other humans that I'm in the room or the space with? And I think what's coming out really loudly is that connection is louder than comparison. It was for me at the reunion, and it is for you guys in this application process, and it is for all of us as old girls. So this is not a paid announcement. That's just my reflection of some of the really deep and unique and potent, you know, benefits that we all share as old girls. I also know for you, Sophie, you're a champion of women. Mm-hmm. You've talked before about the importance of women getting a seat at the table.
Yes.
What does that mean for you? What stops us doing that? And my third part to the question would be, what can all of us do in order to dial up that, you know, possibility of taking that seat?
I guess, what does it mean for me? Well, I grew up with a mum who's an old Lauriston girl, and an auntie who is an old Lauriston girl, and they're very proud, strong women who always told me, as Lauriston did, that the world's our oyster and that you always have to be able to look after yourself. And I think that then pursuing a career in an extremely male-dominated industry, I needed to be able to just feel like I could be a part of it. And there's certainly been lots of frustrations throughout my career when even every day, honestly, I'll be called a nurse, or I will be discriminated against by patients or whatnot, just because of what people think a surgeon should look like. And so for me, the biggest thing is just removing that unconscious bias. And the only way to do that is to make it totally normal for women to have whatever role it is, or whatever leadership role, or have a presence. And then as soon as you make that completely normal, we don't need to worry about anything. the biggest barriers are that we think it's not right for women or minority groups to have leadership roles or to play in non-female dominated careers. And so we feel afraid and we feel inadequate. And I think that we feel like we need to have 150% of the skills to be able to do it instead of having 50% and learning the rest on the job. One of the hardest things in surgical training is it can make you become a bit more like a man because you go into a certain system and you have to keep true to yourself. I think putting your hand up, leaning in and really just trying to remain the person that you are, because whoever you are is what we need, because we need diversity. Don't know if that answered the question.
It absolutely does. It absolutely does. And I think it's food for thought for all of us. I know there'll be a lot of people who can relate to many elements of what you've just shared there. Actually, for you, Steph, can you relate?
Absolutely. I think that the experience of feeling like you need to be 150% across a topic before you are able to participate in it is something that I particularly suffer from. I think I touched on it before when I said taking on a role without already having formal education in it, I found odd. And then I know that, particularly in surgery, I think that, not that I have personal experience with it, but it sounds like the industry is still much more male dominated than the law. Because in Australia now, the majority of solicitors are women. It's like over 50% of practicing solicitors are women. I don't think it's the same across barristers, and it's different between states, but there's a lot more gender parity than we used to have. That said, I still find myself not backing myself in the way that I know that my male counterparts do, even when I probably have more knowledge in a topic than my male counterparts do, and they're putting their hands up for roles and positions that they feel capable of taking. And I think it goes both ways. I think humility is important, and I think that learning to be more outgoing is not necessarily always the safest path. I don't think I'm a naturally outgoing person, but I think that caution and, you know, risk assessment, this is a very lawyerly thing to say, but I think risk assessment is very important. I don't think just throwing myself into something because, you know, she'll be right is always a great idea. But equally, I think that learning on the job is something that women often or traditionally step back from. It's really nice to have the fellowship straddle the line between education, for me anyway, and work, where I get to go through a pathway of educating myself to be better at my job so that I can improve in my workplace. So I'm kind of doing both at the same time. Is teaching me how to do a job that I've already taken on so that I can improve my skills rather than preparing before I leap in.
And yet that means that some part of you made the leap without feeling you had that 150% hit rate, which you're pushing back some of the voices that are playing out in your head.
I'm learning too.
Yeah. You also shared, Sophie, some of pearls of wisdom when you have spoken to old girls at Lauriston. I think I read that three of your top tips for living a good life would be remaining interested in other people, dancing, and finding a kind life partner.
Oh, yes.
Those three jumped out at me. Your list was longer than that, but those three spoke to me. You were singing to the choir there. What do those three things, why are they important?
They're so important to me, actually, those things. Being interested in other people and just not staring at your screen or a TV and having conversations. And for me, the biggest one, so my grandma is 101. She's super old. And I just love talking to her and hearing about her life. Dancing. So I've grown up Latin dancing. I used to teach wedding couples, I was almost like a psychologist or a counselor in those settings, let me tell you. And I think dancing just for me symbolizes freedom and expression and being relaxed and letting go. And lastly, finding a life partner. So I have an incredible husband who is possibly the nicest person in the world. I think that just that process is such a fun thing, and just being true to who you are and them loving you for being a weirdo is such a fun part of life, you know, something to be celebrated.
Is this good kind man a dancer too?
He's got a little groove that he started doing. So he used to do the offbeat John Travolta, you know, and I said, this is not going to work out if you keep doing that. And so he's actually found his own little jig that he does, and it's really cute. So that makes me happy.
If the fellowship, the Lauriston OLA fellowship, you know, included men, we could perhaps get him a dancing fellowship. But
yeah,
unfortunately, he's precluded from applying. Steph, you also have talked about the importance of valuing our strengths and not necessarily carving out a career based on passion alone. What did you mean by that?
Yeah, it's a difficult one, and I think people find it a little bit, when I say this, they sometimes find it a little bit cynical. But I think that I've been through the experience of having a job that was 100% my passion, and on reflection, just because something is your passion doesn't mean that it's a good environment to work in. And particularly, I think this is true for people who have creative drive, is that creativity can be very fragile and very difficult to tap into. There's a lot of self-criticism, and it's very hard to learn how to be a creative properly and sustainably for your emotional well-being and your ability to produce work without being overwhelmed by criticism or the desire to be successful. And it's very hard to be creative and commodify your creativity into a career, because it means that if you're not making money out of what you do, then you must not be good at what you do. And that's never true in a creative outlet. So it's a very fraught career pathway. I think that it's a brilliant career pathway, and I think everyone should follow their creative instincts, and particularly if they're able to have the opportunity to study and develop those skills and maintain them, like Sophie has done with her dancing, like through their life, even when they have other draws on their time. But it's important to give yourself space to let your creative interest, so for me, film, be a passion instead of a career, or a passion separate from a career. It's important to really assess whether you want to do it as a career because you love it or because it's the lifestyle that you want. So film, for me, working in the camera team, it's massive days, it's inconsistent work. You might work for a couple of days and then you are jobless, and then you work for a couple of months and then you're jobless. It's very gig-based. It's 100% who you know. I have, like, a disc injury from lifting heavy stuff, so it's very a lot of toll on your body depending on what roles you work in. The hours are mad. No, the hours are inconsistent. And if you have a partner who's in the industry, it's very difficult to organise any schedules. You can't say no to work because it'll go to someone else, and then the next time the work comes up, it'll go to that second person again. And it's a very small world, and it's a very small industry, and you don't get paid very well. So all those things make it very difficult to have a career there. And I sort of sat back and I said, well, do I want this to be a career, or do I want to have a job that gives me space and money to pursue this as a passion? And that's kind of where I went. And it's the irony is I stepped away from film because it wasn't giving me it wasn't meeting the requirements of my lifestyle. But it's actually, going to law school has given me more useful skills to be a filmmaker almost than film school did. The contract negotiation, understanding the legal parameters of producing a film, understanding how to work with a team in a contractual environment, understanding employment, timelines, budgets, the economics of it, all of those things we touched on a little at film school, but really are legal questions and financial and business questions. Going to law school has probably been one of the most useful steps I could have ever taken in my film career. even when I thought I was stepping away from my film career.
If we have people who are listening who didn't know much about the fellowship and may have an interest in supporting, because the OLA would love to hear from any potential funders that can recognise the many benefits and great value associated with recipients of the fellowship, what would your messages to them be? How has this fellowship impacted or changed the trajectory of your career or the way you think about or feel about your work?
For me, it's been a bit of a game changer. One of the beautiful benefits is how it's rekindled my connection with Lauriston. But also now I'll always look upon this time in my career and I will thank Lauriston for it. Whereas, you know, the last connection with Lauriston was finishing year 12. And so it has made me grateful again, not just for everything Lauriston gave me as a young woman, but now at another stage in my career. And for me, it's made a huge difference. So my fellowship was given to me to allow me to operate on hydrogel models of a male pelvis and to remove the prostate, which means I can use the robot to complete the whole operation on this hydrogel model while someone's teaching me. And that has helped me in many ways. One, because robotic training is actually not a compulsory part of the core curriculum in Australia under the College of Surgeons. And even though the technology is here and will be the way of the future, we haven't caught up with the teaching of it yet. And so the way people are able to excel in that is to seek out other ways to learn it that don't involve operating on a live patient in an operating theatre. And so this learning experience has not only taught me so much, but it's also given me the skills and confidence to now I am operating on people in the operating theatre, and tying it back to my first comments at the start of this talk were about my auntie dying from a surgical complication. I mean, a huge part of how I train and operate is feeling like I've got the appropriate skills before I do operate on a human. This fellowship has just allowed me to do that with so much confidence. And by having that confidence in the skill, then I am actually given more time to operate, and it just goes exponentially from there. So supporting this fellowship for me, and it sounds like for Stephanie as well, it's that little extra step in a time in your career where there isn't that much support out there. You're really just trying to push yourself along and trying to get yourself that little step up or that extra education or that extra training. And to have that support out there at this time in our careers, I think is really unique, and it's not really available anywhere else.
What about for you, Steph?
It's really easy, I feel, to get a couple of years into your career as a professional and start to grind along a specific path, and it's very difficult to make space or time for personal development or career development outside of your institution. So I'm lucky to be extremely supported at my firm, but I know that I never would have saved the money myself or gone out on a limb to try and find someone else to fund or take time off work to take this opportunity for career development if I didn't have the support of Lauriston behind me. And that's partly because of the financial burden, but it's also just it wouldn't have even occurred to me that this could be something that I was capable of doing or that I was worthy of doing in my career. And I think that it takes the career, for me, it felt like I'd reached a crossroads when I got this fellowship of, oh, I'm just me, I'm just a lawyer, to I actually have a massive breadth of interests and skills that with the right pressure behind me, with the right boost, I can really take this into an area where I could be of massive value by combining those skills. Mm-hmm. So we haven't touched on it that much, but the focus of my fellowship is to get directorship training because I'm on a not-for-profit board. And being on a not-for-profit board, you have a very particular set of responsibilities, as well as your classic director's responsibilities. there's a lot of liability for your for people who are relying on you when you're responsible for not-for-profit activities and charitable activities. I think that there's a lot of girls and women who have the wherewithal and the intelligence and the acumen and a particular set of problem-solving skills, the creativity, the curiosity to go from chugging along in their career paths to being career and industry leaders and career and industry standouts with incredible additional skills that they couldn't get without the funding of someone who has been generous in the way that the fellowship has been to us. Mm. Sophie's right about seeing the moment in my career is that when I look back here, I go from being a lawyer a couple of years out of law school to a director with an additional set of skills because I work on a television board and I have film and television training, to someone who is also an exceptional director. And those skills are transferable to other boards, to other charitable organisations, to the production of films, to my improvement as a lawyer because I'll have directorship training. A lot of my clients are directors. Mm-hmm. The growth, as Sophie said, is exponential out from that point. It's not a discrete set of skills that doesn't grow. It's the boost up into the next level of your career, both from a skill set point of view, but just a self-confidence point of view.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mean, I hear both of you saying it's the gift that keeps on giving in both your careers, but also the power of having a community see you, back you, acknowledge you at a time when sometimes that might be low within the self is more powerful than perhaps we could ever know. For someone else to bear witness to your potential.
Yeah, and I think it's a continuation of what I felt when I was at high school. But as Sophie said before, it just drops off once you graduate. It's hard to feel that. It's hard to tangibly feel that you still have that backing and support. And then when this happened, I realised it probably had never gone away.
Yeah, once a Lauriston girl, always a Lauriston girl. Thank you both so much for sharing your career stories, for explaining so articulately and passionately the impact of the fellowship on the work that you do. And I have no doubt that your words will impact others who have listened and hopefully inspire them to apply, follow suit, and recognise the community that we all belong to as old girls.
Thanks so much, Sabina.
Yeah, thank you so much, Sabina. And thank you to the OLA as well. It's been great.
Yeah.